So wait a minute, are we stuck in the mud of an eternal battlefield here? It looks that way, doesn't it? I'm trying to break loose. I jumped the gun last time in my eagerness to bring it to a close, but this is a very important part, how wars close. A thing that keeps recurring to me all the time is how much this is like the Hundred Years' War, which began in 1339 and didn't end till well into the middle of the 15th century. The same war. Would you believe that the Battle of Crecy, which was a duplicate, practically a carbon copy, well, I mean the Battle of Agincourt, when we described it already, Agincourt, 1415, was practically a carbon copy of the War of Crecy, Battle of Crecy, which was 75 years before. It was almost identical. It was the same war, just went on for over 100 years. You don't have to stop these things. Well, we may have reference to that later, but let's go on here and see. See, it wasn't, I jumped to the story of Manti, and it should have been a preliminary story. This time they're trying to hold. And this, the prisoner of war trouble, you notice this nice psychological study. Well, we're in the 57th chapter, and the 28th verse. They entrusted Gid with a lie. See, everything's winding down now. Now they're going to get fooled. This is the interesting thing. Every sign is that the war is ending up. And Moroni is going to have a knock, get it all over with and wipe things up. We're going to have a wiping up operation. It doesn't work at all. The whole thing collapses. And Moroni is fit to be tied because his whole great plan had fallen through. He isn't as great a general as he thinks he is, or something. We inquired of Gid concerning the prison. Now Gid was appointed to guard them, take this huge amount of prisoners. As they're taking them toward the city of Kumeni, that's the city of Kumeni, a very good ancient word, and belongs to the Mediterranean, the city of Kumeni. They got news that a huge Lamanite army was already attacking Kumeni, and the guards were obviously disturbed. There was the prisoners noticed there was tension among them, so this was their chance to break out. Remember, they're not guarding them with automatic weapons at all. They just have swords and so forth. So what they all did, it says, the prisoners heard their cries, which caused them to take courage, and they rise up in rebellion against us. When they realized that the Nephites were in distress, they didn't like it. Well, this was a blessing, actually. They ran in a body on our swords. The remainder of them nearly all broke loose and escaped, but that's what they wanted. They didn't have to have them anymore. So they rushed on to Kumeni, which they couldn't have done otherwise, and arrived there just in time to rescue the town. So that's a good thing, you never know. Then our next object was Manti. Now, Manti was the big objective. What could they do? None of their tricks worked, you see. They remembered that which we'd hitherto done in the 58th chapter. They knew what we'd done already. And so we couldn't pull any fasteners like that. And we couldn't decoy them away anymore. And so now the comes, they settle down to a long wait. As I say, they say the war should be over by now. What's wrong? Now this long and painful wait starts, and it's the biggest trial of all. They waited for provisions from Zarahemla, but they were just a little trickle. They weren't getting any at all. The Lamanites were receiving great strength from day to day on their part. This is beginning to look bad. What's about this ending this war? And they began sallying force against us, taking courage and giving us a bad time. And they, seventh verse, and they waited, and then they waited many months. They were just stuck in this particular place for many months. Remember what Clausewitz says, the longer a war drags on, the greater the losses and the greater the uncertainty of what's going to happen. It's a terrible thing, and wars have that habit of dragging on whether you'd like them to or not. This inaction became terrible. And we received 2,000 men, but he says, that's all we got. This is all the assistance we received. The same thing happened just before the Bulge when Patton ran out of gas. His tank, his whole charts just ground to a halt. Why? For political reasons, as we learned here. It was politics. Churchill wanted Monty to get the glory of ending the war, and you know, they had that northern, still this dagger thrust the heart of Europe north, and so he wanted to give all the gas to Monty, and Monty was bound down. He didn't make any progress at all. But that's what happened, you see, and needless to say, Patton didn't like it at all. Oh, there were terrible political squabbles about that. And we didn't know. Why aren't they sending, notice the ninth verse, why don't they send us more strength to us? We don't know what's going on here. Well, at least we don't want to be in the dark. What kind of information? We began to grieve. We're filled with fear. The judgments of God, perhaps we're not going to win after all. They resorted to prayer. They waited. And that was a great consolation. It had peace to their souls, and it granted us great faith. See, this is the real test, these long waits you have to go through and so forth. And so they had a new plan. This is what I was mentioning the end of the last time. They went forth against the city, in the city of Manti, with everything we had, and we pitched our tents on the wilderness side, which was near the city. Now, this was a provocation. It was right near the city. And on the morrow, when they came, they sent their spies and what was happening on, but they were afraid that if we were to settle down there, we'd get more support. That would be bad. That would have to stop. See, we're cutting, well, no. The fear that we should cut them off from their support, they're receiving more support, and we're camped right practically under the gates. They've got to do something about it. They've got to stop this. So now we're forcing them to come out. And what's more, it tells us in the 15th verse, they thought it would be an easy operation. They could easily destroy us with their numerous hosts. Be nothing to it. They just come out and do it. So that's the way we were able to draw them out. And of course, Gid, on one hand, and Teomer on the other, they had on either side of the path through which they were to go. Naturally, when they come out, the army camp there is going to retreat, drawing them out again, the usual thing. But this is done over and over again. I mentioned the Battle of Poitiers the last time. The reason it was won is because the Black Prince, what he did, he hid his banner so no one could see where he was, and he hid all men in some bushes on a hill at Poitiers there, and gave the impression that he'd run away, see. So, of course, then the whole French force decided to take off after him. They were on either side, and they did the very same thing that's done here. It's an old trick, and it works. So they could easily destroy us. So it caused Gid, with his small number, that he should secrete himself in the wilderness. Well, it was a high willow, typical of that part of France, high willow underbrush and so forth. And there were a lot of vineyards nearby. Anything to slow down the attack. It worked very well, too. Hid himself in the wilderness, and also Teomer on a small band, and there are the other side, see, so they go between them. But that isn't the main point. Gid and his men on the right, and the others were on the left. I remained with the remainder of my army in the same place where we'd first pitched our tents. They're still taunting them, trying to get them to come out. The others are all in place. Now we're ready for our squeeze play here. I caused that my men then should retreat into the wilderness. So, of course, now they follow. The Lamanites did follow with great speed, and we did pass right between Gid and Teomer, and went right on that way. So they closed the way behind them. Gid and Teomer then did rise up from their secret places, cut off the spies of the Lamanites, ran to the city, and took possession of the city. And then what? We took our course toward the land of Zarahemla. And the pursuing army saw they're coming towards Zarahemla, which was the big one. They wouldn't dare do that. They imagined they feared a trap then. This must be something. This has been too good. It's been too easy. They were exceedingly afraid, yet lest there was a plan laid to trap them. So what were they going to do? They began to retreat to the wilderness again. And before they went back, they'd been a strenuous effort. So they slept that night. They went to sleep. But while they were sleeping, the entire Nephite army had been chasing, went around behind them, and went back to the city, which is ready to receive them. And so the city of Manti was in their possession when they came back. Caused my men a deep sleep. Now, they should not sleep. They should march around behind them, go back to Manti because of our march in the nighttime. We did arrive before them at the city of Manti. We outmarched them here. And then we took possession of the city without the shedding of blood. And the armies of the Lamanites arrived near the city, saw what had happened. They were filled with great fear, and all they had to do was their usual thing, take off to the wilderness and be gone. Now the war seems to be over. It's ranging around in wanton destruction. Our fathers and our women and our children are returning to their homes. Notice that everybody's going back home again now. They know the game is over. Everybody knows who's going to win, and everybody knows who's over, and so everybody's starting to relax. But that's a very dangerous thing to do, and they do it, you see. Now, we do not know, but here, this is Helaman's letter reporting, you see. He says, we do not know the cause that the government doesn't grant us more strength. Neither those men who came to us know why we haven't received greater strength. What's going on there? Whether it was inside political fighting or something going on, you see. Now, we don't desire to murmur, he says, but we fear that there is some faction in the government which is exactly what was, you see. In fact, they'd taken over the government. Some faction in the government that they did not send more men. Notwithstanding the weakness of our armies, we believe that the Lord will deliver us out of the hands of our enemies. And the Lamanites have fled back home to the land of Nephi. Remember, the land of Nephi was a Lamanite land. Behold, we've received many wounds there. It's not a happy situation. They've been there a long time. It's slowing down. that you may have success in obtaining possession of all that which the Lamanites have taken away from us. That's what the issue is, to get back that which the Lamanites had taken away from them. See, this was not a war of aggression or anything like that. Just take it back. Take back the territories. That's the way ancient wars do. You seize territories. And the object of ancient wars is not to have battle, but to avoid battle. All the wars of the Middle Ages. For example, Edward III would go over to France and to reclaim his lands, which the French claimed the king had just run over. And what would happen? He'd destroy everything in sight, everything. He'd spend months, and there'd be no pitched battle. The French king wouldn't engage him, and he wouldn't engage him. They'd avoid it. Well, what was he doing? Well, this country now, Anjou or something like that, now represents the, now belongs to France. He had to be called it France. So the best thing he can do is to destroy it, because that's it. That's the way he gets at his enemies, destroying everything he has. So he destroys all the villages, destroys all the crops, destroys all, kills everything. And they do that for months, ranging around like that, with no intention of having a battle. Then he goes back to England, and with a great fanfare, banners flying and so forth, have a great celebration. Then the French king comes back, because remember at that time a large part of England, southwestern France, belonged to England. He'd come back and overrun the land and do the very same sort of thing. It was wild. And it gets worse. And remember, the whole thing, this long war, ends up in what? Organized crime. That's where. Just exactly as we go into the book of Helaman from this. Without a break, we go into the organized crime of the book of Helaman. So, this is the issue. Now, after Moroni had read this letter of Helaman's, he rejoiced greatly that they'd been holding their own, and he announced to the land round about, and he immediately sent an epistle to Pahoran to strengthen Helaman. To the judge, he says, why don't you give more power, more give the forces to Helaman? And then he, this is the first letter he sends to Pahoran, do that. Now the war is virtually over, so he has a master plan to wind it up, see, that's what he's going to do. He's going to roll up the whole front and end it all. We had great plans like that in the last war. Very people, and they didn't work. To lay a plan, notice it tells us that's what it was. He began to lay a plan that he might obtain the remainder of those possessions of the cities which had been taken from. There were a lot of these cities. And he was, I'd say, just to roll up the front and take them one after another. And the main city to begin with was the key city was Nephihah. He wanted to make a clean sweep. And from there he intended to go to the city of Moroni and the city of Lehi and the city of Morianton, and which had been attacked by the Lamanites. See, he was going. And the ousted Lamanites. What's happened? Remember, they'd driven a lot of Lamanites out of cities so far. What did they do? They went over and joined the Lamanite army and made it stronger. They didn't all go home. Some of them did, and we'll see more of them start going home. They'd come over and join the Lamanites in this part of the land. So they were having a buildup. And this is just exactly like, I say, the bulk, because it's a long buildup, it's a big one, and it catches them completely by surprise. It catches the great Moroni by surprise. Under command of Amoron, that's that rascal again, they came forth against the people of Nephi, and all of a sudden, it was just like the bulls, a massive breakthrough, caught them completely by surprise and rolled over one city after another. The people would flee from one city to the next, and they'd all gang together and flee from that one. And it was a brilliant success for Amoron. The people of Nephi were obliged to flee before them, and they came even and joined the army of Moroni. They came to it. They're building up on each side. But notice, he swept down on them all of a sudden, Nephihah, and they did begin to slay them with exceeding great slaughter. And he joined the army of Moroni. And now Moroni had supposed, see, he was wrong. Moroni had supposed, notice the last line of this ninth verse, that they should easily maintain the city. He had not left Nephihah sufficiently defended. He thought it would be strong enough to hold its own. The Lamanites were weakened. They'd lost their morale. Things were running down and so forth. We can relax. Remember, 110th Division, which was new, had only been 2 weeks in Europe, had never had any combat, knew nothing at all very green, covering 28 lines of front, two lines from a dozen German divisions, including three powerful tank divisions, just 2 miles away there. And they fooled us completely. It didn't fool us. I said, it didn't fool me, but it didn't do any good. I made out a situation map. I told them what was going to happen, and it did. I knew even the day, because a sacred, a special day with Hitler, who followed astrology, was the 17th of December. I said, the 17th of December is going to be a breakthrough. The 6th paratroop will come through here, and the 3rd Panzer and so forth. This is what's going to happen, rather the 10th. And so what's going to happen? And this is what happened here, notice, that Moroni should have been fooled. He supposed he would easily maintain the city, because you want to believe that. We didn't want to go. They told us when we sent and went down to Corps that day to find out, do you have any maps? Have you sent out? We haven't sent out any patrol because we're moving tomorrow. Can't you see? We're all packing this stuff, and they were packing everything. Don't bother us. We're going away. We're going to retire and going to a rest area and so forth. So that's what happens. Now, when Moroni saw the city of Nephi was lost, he was exceedingly sorrowful, his pet project, you see. And he began to doubt because of the wickedness of the people. And I have to blame someone, as Clausewitz says, you always have to blame somebody in the war, and that's always possible to find somebody. He blamed the wickedness of the people, and his chief captains stand around nodding agreement. They doubted and marveled, and see, this was the case with all his chief captains. They doubted and marveled also because of the wickedness of the people. The staff agrees. But then he takes the next step, of course, and blames the government. That was it. Came to pass that Moroni was angry with the government. He didn't know who the government was. They'd been completely replaced by a lot of rascals. And so he wrote again to the governor who was Pahoran, and if you think his letter on the exchange of prisoners to Amoron was tactless, this one breaks all the rules for lack of tact and so forth, but it isn't. There's a point to this letter, you'll see. It makes pretty good sense after all. He wrote to Pahoran, who was the chief judge and governor, and also to all those who have been chosen by the people to manage the affairs of the war. Now he says, you've been chosen to manage the national defense, and you're not doing it, he says in the second verse. As a matter of fact, they weren't. By the way of condemnation, I have something to say of them by way of condemnation. You have been appointed to gather together men and arm them and protect the country, see his swords, against the Lamanites in whatever parts they should come. But you're not giving us any support, he says. Our men have suffered exceedingly. Great has been the slaughter among our people. While it might have been otherwise, if you'd rendered unto our armies sufficient strength, we could have stopped all this, he says. Yea, great has been your neglect toward us. He has a picture of people quite prosperous back home, so he describes them later on. Now we desire to know the cause. What's wrong here? And then he says he knows the cause already in the same verse. The cause of your thoughtless state is because you're sluggish and reluctant and incompetent and everything else. We desire to know the cause of exceedingly great neglect. We desire to know the cause of your thoughtless state. He jumps to a conclusion. Could you think to sit, this is a marvelous passage, isn't it? Could you think to sit upon your thrones in a state of thoughtless stupor? He gets some good digs in, and Moroni does, in more than nice. There's a picture, it's humorous, it's clownish, in a state of thoughtless stupor. While your enemies are spreading the work of death around you, yea, while they are murdering thousands of your brethren, they've looked to you for protection. What are you giving them, he says? Behold, you've withheld our provisions. Well, had they withheld them? I have an interesting parallel here, I'm going to bring along here. Behold, this is not all. We have withheld your provisions. And now, my beloved brethren, for you ought to be beloved, you ought to have stirred yourselves more diligently for the welfare. You have neglected them so much that the blood of thousands shall come upon your heads for vengeance. Do you suppose you could sit upon your thrones because of your exceeding goodness of God? You can trust in him like they did at Saloniki, the last of the great Turkish overthrows, because the people at Saloniki thought God would bless them and they couldn't possibly lose. Well, they were wrong because they had Greek fire. They had a secret weapon that could wipe out them. But the enemy had it too. They didn't know that. Well, and he says, do you suppose so many of your brethren have been killed is because of their wickedness? It's their own fault if they're poor. We say things like that. It's their own fault if they have bad luck. It's their own part if they get beat. He says, you suppose that they're to guilt because it's their wickedness? No, it's your condemnation. And then he says an interesting thing. This seems to be a settlement that makes everybody unhappy. For the Lord suffereth the righteous to be slain, that his justice and judgment may come upon the wicked. He lets the wicked go ahead and be wicked so that he can punish them. But the righteous take a beating in the meantime. Well, what kind of justice is that? You say, well, that's the way the world goes. People make all sorts of... Therefore, and this is the point he gets to, you see. They're not lost because they're slain. You think they are. But this is the point. They're not lost beyond their slain. The Lord, they do enter into the rest of the Lord their God. And as we saw from the case of Ammon and viewing the burning of the women and children and so forth, it looked like such a terrible thing. And Ammon said, don't stop it. Was it Ammon and his friend? Because it's not so bad as you think. For the righteous, it isn't bad at all, as far as that goes. And now behold, it's a brief moment. Now behold, I say unto you, I fear exceedingly the judgments of God will come upon this people because of their exceeding slothfulness. See, there's a crime. Not to do anything, it can be sinful. As I say, the first rule of the Russian, of the Generalstab to any officer is, do something. It's better to do the worst possible thing than to do nothing. That's a very strong thing to say, but that's the slogan, you see, because you must do something. And slothfulness. Are we exceedingly slothful today? Well, in what regard are we exceedingly slothful? What are we supposed to be finding out? Even the slothfulness of our government and exceedingly great neglect toward their brethren. Well, we're certainly neglecting our brethren. This is a self-centered, a me generation. It's an interesting thing here. This is a tendency in the country here. At Ramsgate, this is the thing that would happen, taking off for one operation at Ramsgate at night. The permanent cadre, the staff that were there, were having a big party. They were having a binge, having a great old time. They're nearly all drunk. And when our boys got out to load onto the C-47s, the Dakotas, these slow, lumbering old things, very good workhorses, but not very fast, come in at 55 miles an hour, anything can blast them out of the air. They lined up on either side and shouted as they went down, "Goodbye, suckers, you'll be sorry, you'll be," they were laughing their heads off, "you'll be sorry, goodbye, suckers, goodbye, suckers." And I knew they were secretly envious. They were secretly envious of these. They said, "Goodbye, suckers." But they were envious of them, actually. They knew they were doing what they should be doing, you see. Well, they all got drunk that night. Some terrible things happened as a result that I find later on when, in Schwäbisch Gmünd, when I, overnight, in passing through a place, I was billeted with a gang of that same crew from Ramsbury, from Ramsgate. They told what happened that night. We won't go into that. Not to us, but to them. Were it not for the wickedness, well, it was to us after all, were it not for the wickedness which first commenced at our head, again, you notice, civilization always dies at the top. This, I mean, this oneness that I'm doing all right, the me first. At Athens, the colonel in charge of, I was there a few years ago, and the colonel in charge of the base there at Athens was, I just joined the church, a very good man. And they had just had a test, a psychological test in brainwashing, which is a big thing in those days because there was so much brainwashing in various parts of the world. And they tried, they had on the Greek soldiers and they tried it on the American soldiers. They could never brainwash the Greek soldiers. They could never shake a Greek at all. They felt loyalty to each other. They felt a brotherhood there. It was very strong. With the Americans, it was a cinch. You have to show each individual it's to your advantage. They offered him things if they would give away. Of course, it was an imaginary situation, but they put on depression. But the minute they offered them strong inducements in your own interest, this will get you promotion, you get money, anything they would offer him, anything they wanted, or you'll get the best rations and so forth, assuming they're prisoners of war, you see. And he says the Americans would tumble every time. They would, for their own particular interest, they'd be willing to sell out anyone. That was very, very disturbing. Whereas the Greeks, you couldn't get them to do it no matter what you did. And can we be true and faithful if it's the me first generation? I'm glad the 80s is coming to a close. I don't think it's going to last. Well, the wickedness first commenced our head. Again, civilization always dies at the top. You can't say it dies at the bottom. You can't say the great unwashed, the rabble responsible for the overthrowing of anything. They're always there. The Lord says, the poor you have always with you. If you want to practice your charity, then you're free to do it, as he said to Judas. But of course, when it's at the top, if there's failing at the top, then a civilization will decline. So even the bottom is dead level. You don't have to worry about them. They're always there. You always have people, the riffraff, you always have inner cities and things like that. When the people at the top lose their integrity, the wickedness which first commenced at our head, that's where it begins, you see. Had it not been for the war which broke out among ourselves, it was those kingmen's, it was this politics business that caused so much bloodshed among ourselves. Yea, at the time we were contending among ourselves. If we'd been united in strength as we had hitherto been done, this never would have happened. It's the personal factor again. You see, the desire for power and authority which those kingmen had over us. They had the authority over us. The desire of certain individuals for power and office and authority and so forth. So, without that, we'd have no trouble at all. We should have dispersed our enemies. It would have been done according to the fulfilling of his word. The word is not always fulfilled. Well, no, he says his word is always conditional. If you keep my commandments, he said, we'd have had no trouble at all. We would have dispersed our enemies without trouble. But behold, now the Lamanites are coming and taking possession of our lands. All of a sudden, like that. We got here. This because of the great wickedness of those who are seeking for power and authority, yea, even those king men. Well, why not? We know not but what you yourselves are seeking for authority. Now he's right to power on in his and the government, you see. We know not but what you yourselves are seeking for authority. Well, he doesn't know. He admits he doesn't know, but now he assumes he does and talks to them like a Dutch uncle, you see. This is just a suggestion, though. He knows something is very wrong, and this is what it naturally is. Because remember, he had had a lot of experience already with these kingmen. He knew how they operated. He knew what the situation was, and he knew their strength and their appeal here. So, we know not what yourselves are seeking authority. We know not what you're also traitors to your country, as far as you're concerned. Ye are surrounded by security, yet you cause food not cause food to be sent unto us and also our men to strengthen our arms. Have you forgotten the commandments of the Lord? You see, he starts lecturing them like this. Thus, do you suppose that the Lord will deliver us while we sit upon our thrones and do not make use of the means which the Lord has provided us? He changed the person there. Make use of the means which the Lord has provided for us. You notice the Lord is not going to come and rescue you while you sit on your throne, he says. He has provided you with the means. He says, I'm reminding you, you have the means, and what we want is that. Again, will you sit in idleness while you're surrounded with thousands of those tens of thousands who do sit in idleness? So everybody wasn't out at war at all. It wasn't the Nephites versus the Naamanites. It was a relatively small armies going out and doing this thing. 4,000 men was as much as they got. 2,000 was quite a host, to see where they could get them. And so here, he was sitting in idleness, so I surrounded by tens of thousands stayed at home, while there are thousands around about the borders of the land who are falling by the sword, yea, wounded and bleeding, going on. He makes this as dramatic as possible. It's a rhetorical question, of course. Will you be guiltless if you sit still and behold these things? Inactivity, it can be a crime here. The inward vessel shall be cleansed first. And I'm talking about you, he says. This is a well-known proverb at the time. What we call cosmetic improvements should wait, you see. The dress standards, the campus, the Mormon tells us. It's the inner part of the vessel that comes first. We don't care much about that, but we're great on the outer part of the vessel here, aren't we? The covenants come first, which we made, you see, keeping them. But we like to say it's the little things that count. Well, here's an interesting item that came from the paper on Saturday. It's very interesting. No, yesterday. Yeah. No, day before yesterday. Yeah, that's right, Saturday. This is Lebanon. Today, you know what's been going on? Everybody's shooting up. They never stop shooting in the town, the two factions, you see. While shells slammed into Beirut Saturday night, the moneyed elite of the Fakhra Club, Fakhra means entertainment, relaxation, the Fakhra Club, an hour's drive from the burning city, dined and danced the night away to the strains of whatever will be, will be. They're like people from another planet. Said, this is just the way our friend Rami's writing now. They're like people from another planet, said one West Beirut resident, who had suffered months of artillery bombardments in a city without power and short of food and water. Well, that's exactly power on Moroni's situation, isn't it? Well, what do the people in the... What do the others do? At the mountain resort, the conflict seemed a long way off, even though the Syrian front lines are only 2 miles away. In the swimming pools, on the tennis courts, in the expensive French restaurants, Lebanon's smart set is displaying its traditional zest for life as if nothing had happened. They go on living it up while all these people are dying around them. Exactly the situation in the Book of Mormon. Strange coincidence, isn't it? Strange people, a strange land. These people, remember, these same stock as Laman's people. Can you imagine that with this, it sounds like Moroni talking, like Moroni talking, doesn't it? Can you imagine that with this sort of madness we are still building ski resorts, said the hotel manager, Nicholas Catan. Catan feels the club proves the point. Lebanon must prevail, however bad the situation on the streets of the battered capital. If we did not have this, we would have disappeared a long time ago, he says, the psychology of keeping up the morale. At least 760 civilians have been killed and 3,000 wounded in the past 5 months of madness as Syria, backed by the leftist and Muslim militia allies and Christian army commander Michael Aoun, who is the worst, forces sought to destroy each other. The Fakhra Club is a chalet development northeast of Beirut, boasts 3 restaurants, 2 bars, a swimming pool, tennis courts, and a squash club. For those able to afford $300,000 for a lot, to buy land and build a chalet, it's not a bad place to sit out the war. It has its own roads, garage, wells, and generators, and enough supplies to last 1,000 people for 6 months. So within a few miles, within easy hearing distance, there you are. The same thing going on that we have here, and it happens in our world. How selfish people can be. How selfish we all are, aren't we? And so he goes on here. Sit in idleness while thousands are dying and all this sort of thing. These people are living, they have no food, they have nothing, they have no power or anything in the city, and yet these people don't give it the slightest concern. They're living the life of Riley up there, and They're rich, they're buying property, they're building chalets up there. It's absurd, as the manager of the hotel said. Can you imagine it? Well, and will we be guiltless? Let us get, now he stirs them. Harp and Kark, Thomas Harp and Kark, along with me, begin to be up and doing, he says. Notice the 24th verse. It will be expedient that we contend no more with the Lamanites until we've first cleansed our inward vessel, yea, even the great head of our government. Now he brings accusations, you see. This house cleaning. What did I mark 49:11 here for? Oh, yes, I remember here that it was earlier that it was, I just had noted this fact earlier, that it was, remember, Moroni himself, before he launched out in his great enterprises, had altered the management of the affairs among the Nephites. He had a big shake-up, a complete political otherwise shake-up, put things in order before he started out for his big defense project. Now he wants to do it again. We have to cleanse house again, he said, the inward vessel, even the great head of government. So he'd been authorized to do it before, you see. He'd been given plenary powers and he did it. Now he's going to use those powers and reorganize the government. He says, if I have to. It's not as crazy as you think, see here. I will leave the strength of blessings of God upon them, and none other power can operate. So he's going to leave his men under the strength and blessings of God, and he's going to go to town. And I will come unto you, and if there be any among you who has a desire for freedom, even a spark of freedom, he gets caustic here, spark of freedom remaining, I will stir up insurrections among you. And that's a fine way for the general to talk, isn't it? Who desires, and those who desire... Notice he doesn't specify whoever it is what he's saying here. Those who have desires to usurp power and authority shall become extinct. They're the ones he's after. He says, I'm going to put them out of operation. Those who have desire to have power and authority. Nay, I do not fear your power nor your authority. He has a lot of certainty here. It's because of your iniquity that we have suffered much loss. Whose iniquity? He's not charging anyone particular. See, whoever it is who's caused this, he says. You who have desires to serve it, whoever it is. And so he says, the time is now at hand. Who is he addressing? We see now. The time is now at hand. You're the time... that except you do bestir yourselves in defense of your country and your little ones, you, sword of justice hangs over you, yea, and it shall fall upon you, whoever it is, to your utter destruction. Except you do administer to our relief, behold, I come to you, even in the land of Zarahemla, and smite you with a sword. Now, this is open rebellion, he's promising, you see, this happens too. You shall no more have power to impede the progress of this people. Behold, the Lord will not suffer that ye shall live and wax strong in your iniquities and destroy this righteous people. He's hotter than firecracker here. Behold, can you suppose that the Lord will spare you and come out in judgments against the Lamanites? Now he makes a case for the Lamanites. They're not the bad ones after all. When it is the tradition of their fathers that has caused them their hatred, and it has been redoubled by those who have descended from us, they've gone over and joined the Lamanites. While your iniquity is for the cause of your love of glory and the vain things of the world, they thought they were fighting for a cause of some sort. They're less reprehensible, but you're just ambitious. You'd want to be big shots, and that will do it. You know that you transgress the laws of God, and you know that you trample them under feet. Behold, if the Lord has said unto me, if those whom ye have appointed to be your governors do not repent of their sins and iniquities, ye shall go up and do them battle. The guilty parties, you see. So, behold, if you will not do this, I come to you speedily. God will not suffer that we should perish with hunger. This is a desperate situation. See, they're perishing with hunger. Therefore, he will give unto us your food, even if it must be by the sword. We'll come and take the food if you have to have it. Now see that ye fulfill the word of God. I seek not for power, but to pull it down. We find out a little later that he retires at the age of 39. Could have become the dictator of the country. He was the national hero and so forth. He never raised a sword again. He died at the early age of 47, apparently from wounds, because he went through a lot of things, you see, because he didn't live very long after that, just 8 years after he retired. He was still under 40. Well, soon after Moroni had sent this epistle to the chief governor, he received the answer from Pahoran. Now I'm going to talk about the Bar Kokhba letters here. It's a very interesting thing. In 1966, as we put it together, we wrote a review of this book of Yadin's here. And they found the Bar Kokhba letters. And Bar Kokhba was the great hero who was going to deliver the Jews from the Romans in 130 A.D., that's where these letters come from. I spell it this way. They spell it this way in this particular, sometimes with CH, sometimes with K. But this is the way Radin spells it in his book on the Bar Kokhba letters. Well, in the Cave of Letters in 1966, they found documents from farms and people, well, mentioned here. For example, I was talking about some things, if you can find them. Yes. The extreme end of the Cave of Letters on the north side of the Nahal Haver, that's the very deep gorge, very much like Rock Canyon, I've been up it, between 3 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon of 15 March 1961, remember the day, Professor Yadin put his hand into a crevice in the floor of the cave and lifted out a goatskin bag containing a woman's materials for mending her family's clothes on their sad and forced vacation. They're hiding out there, you see, not too far from Jerusalem. Stuffed away under the stuff at the very bottom of the bag was a bundle of papyrus rolls in a cloth, and we have among those with a deed to the farm in Engedi and so forth, and this is what the situation is in the Bar Kokhba. Now we have actual Bar Kokhba is the great hero of the Jews. Is he a real historical figure? Yes, he's real because we have letters actually signed by his hand were found in that cave. So this is what he tells us. This is the situation. They weren't getting any help from the Jews at headquarters, from the Jews up north at Ein Gedi. Why weren't they getting any help? Yes. Bar Kokhba's war, like Moroni's, is a holy war. The Messianic War, it's called, with fatal concern for the temple, with fanatical concern for the temple. In the struggle for liberation, the hero found his hands full dealing with all kinds of people and problems. These are the letters of Bar Kokhba. For one thing he found, I'm quoting now, some of the wealthier citizens of the city were evaders of national duties. We're right back in Moroni's position. Moroni Bar Kokhba, you see. Evaders of national duties in his day, as their ancestors had been in the days of Nehemiah, he says, Nehemiah 3 and 5. Specifically, they were disregarding the mobilization orders of Bar Kokhba. They weren't joining up at all. Who became exceedingly angry and issued dire threats against them, including the death penalty. Compare this with the Rona in a like situation, you see, and it came, we quote some of these things we've just been talking about here. And then Bar Kokhba had to deal with just such characters, and he did it in the same way Moroni did. To the brothers, and he calls them his brethren, just as Moroni does, to all whom he writes, in the city of Ein Gedi, he personally wrote a letter in Hebrew that survives to this day, to Masbala and to Jehonathan and to Bayan peace. In comfort you sit eating and drinking in the property of the house of... In comfort you sit eating and drinking. Doesn't that have a familiar ring? You sit upon your thrones in a state of thoughtless stupor, enjoying yourselves while we go hungry, he said. And we continue, sit eating and drinking from the property of the house of and care nothing for your brothers. State of thoughtless stupor, don't give any care for at all. Now, if this had been discovered before Joseph Smith's day, I mean, you'd say, well, what obvious plagiarism, that's so gross. I mean, it's just too apparent for words. But wars are very much alike, I'm afraid. Thus, Yadin, we have italicized it to point these out. And then to Pahoran, the city of Zarahemla, to all those, can you think to sit in the top of the work of death around you, yet while you're murdering thousands of your brethren? He uses the same expressions here. And you care nothing for your brothers, says, that's Yadin's translation here of the Hebrew letter. It's easy enough, it's clear Hebrew to read. For nothing of your brothers, and Moroni says, while they're murdering thousands of your brethren. He goes on. And then, sounds like shockingly severe. The provocation was terrible. Moroni, like Bar Kokhba, was holding on by the skin of his teeth. Whatever we may think of Bar Kokhba's harsh tone, this is Yadin commenting on Bar Kokhba's letter, it is very harsh, as Moroni's letter is harsh. And then he says, whatever we may think of Bar Kokhba's harsh tone, it is quite clear that Jehonathan, an important leader, was not the most loyal of subordinates. He hadn't been able to trust him. And there were others like him in high offices, especially as things grew worse in situation. But if the secret, now this is their difference between them. We'll put the date down, the famous date, A.D., the second and last siege of Jerusalem. But if the secret of Moroni's success was his essential gentleness, he brought the Lamanites around, actually. When things were, as soon as they could get rid of the Shakmach, as soon as the king was dead, remember Shak is the Shah, same as Persian Shah, and Mach is the word for dead in all Semitic languages. And the Germans call it Schach, we call it Chess, that comes from that. The Russians call it Shachmach, they give it the whole name. The king is dead. But once the king is gone, once the Shah is gone, you have all his men, you see. So your object is not to wipe out as many pieces as you can on the board, but to save as many pieces as you can. That's where your skill is, because that army's going to be yours when you win. So this is the Asiatic policy of Shakmats, which becomes the great game they play. The same case here. The secret of Moroni's success was his essential gentleness. He always called a halt to the fighting the instant the enemy, whom he called his brethren, showed the least inclination to parley. It has often been said that Bar Kokhba carried through with his threats. And that was his undoing. He could have won if he hadn't done that. He didn't follow the policy that Moroni did, who becomes immediately softened when he reads the letter of Pahoran. He really understands what's going on then. But here we have this one, Bar Kokhba. It has often been said that Bar Kokhba's undoing was lack of such a redeeming quality. Quoting Yadin, his brutality, according to some sources, was manifested by the way he killed the revered Rabbi Eliezer Motin, who Bar Kokhba suspected of betraying the secrets of Bethar, a city under attack to the Romans. Remember, the attacking cities, besieging cities. He expects that a certain rabbi has betrayed him in a city, so he puts the rabbi to death. The rabbi hadn't betrayed him, and so on. It's a Book of Mormon situation very much here, isn't it? This cruel act, according to the same sources, we're quoting still, quoting Yadin, this cruel act, according to the same sources, caused Bar Kokhba's death and the fall of Bethar. He lost his case because he was cruel. When another leader, now this is a part that's very interesting here, when another leader, Galgula, was called to task for holding out supplies, why haven't you brought us supplies? Just exactly the same thing, of course, Moroni says, only this time it's Bar Kokhba writing. This is Galgula. Well, he's calling him to task. This is still Bar Kokhba before the collapse. He was called to task for holding out supplies, including a cow. He wrote to his superiors to explain. Were it not for the Gentiles, now this is Pahoran's explanation, you say, were it not for the Gentiles, the Romans, he calls them the Gentiles, the ethnoi, the goi, were it not for the Gentiles who are near us, we would have gone up and satisfied you concerning this, lest you say that it is out of contempt that I didn't go to you with the food. You see, we've been held up. The Gentiles have blocked our way. They've taken over, and we couldn't get to you. And I want you to know this. He says, lest you get the wrong idea, and you say that it is out of contempt that I did not go to you. Moroni said the same thing. And Pahoran replies, just as Galgula did, it is those who have sought to take away the judgment seat from me that have caused this great iniquity. They have withheld our provisions and have daunted our freemen, that they have not come to you. In your epistle you have censured me, but it mattereth not, I'm not angry. So this is exactly the same situation again. The food couldn't get through, and I'm glad, I want you to know why, so that you won't get mad and censor me for it. So these parallels, I say, are not only striking, sometimes they're positively stunning. You wonder, where has Joseph been to pick up all this information about how things were done in those days? So we get the letter here. And behold, it came to pass, soon after Moroni sent the epistle, he received an epistle from Pahoran. Now this is interesting. Why hadn't he heard from him long before? He immediately explains why. A state of complete crisis, and not only complete insecurity, but everything was totally disrupted. The communications and everything else. He tells the situation, I, Pahoran, I'm not mad at you, he says. I do not joy in your great affliction. Yea, it grieves my soul. But behold, there are plenty of people who do rejoice in your affliction. See, you're right when you feel that something is wrong back there. There are those who do joy in your afflictions, insomuch that they have risen up in rebellion against me. Very seriously. And my people who are freemen, and they're extremely numerous, they've taken over the government. They have sought to take away the judgment seat from me that had been the cause of this great iniquity. They had a putsch, complete takeover. They used great flattery. What is flattery? Remember, promises, hyperbole, good guys, standing tall, greatest civilization, this sort of, that's flattery, you see. And so they have led away the hearts of many of the people by that sort of talk, which caused a sore affliction among us. They have withheld your provisions. They have daunted our freemen, so we couldn't get through, you see. That they have not come to you. They have daunted our freedom. They have blocked the way so that they couldn't come to you. So not only intimidation, but they've taken over everything. I have fled, so they had to flee out. I wasn't even in Zarahemla, you see, when your letters came. I have sent a proclamation throughout the land. They're flocking to us daily to arms. There's a backlash. See, they've gone too far. That those who have risen up in rebellion against me do fear us. We've got so numerous now, because joining the others, I say the backlash is beginning to be noticed. They have got possession of the land and city of Zarahemla. They've appointed a king over them, and he hath written to the king of the Lamanites, and they're in cahoots with the Lamanites now. Things are going to look very bad. This war isn't going to end the way we thought, you see, unless something is done and done in a hurry. See, just when you think everything is going right, the sort of things that can happen, you never can be sure here. unto the king of the Lamanites, in which he hath joined in alliance with him. So now they're in alliance with the Lamanites. And their idea is to partition the authority later on, but you know perfectly well that Ammonihah is going to take a hold over the whole thing when he can. This is the Amalekites' idea, you see. They shall be placed a king over the people. They shall be conquered under the Lamanites. See, the Lamanites were not politically minded, but they were looked to as a power base for ambitious individuals of either side to keep things stirring up and, of course, supply them with forces. Now, I, Paran, do not seek for power. You think I do? I don't, any more than you do, he says. Save only to retain my judgment seat, that I may preserve the rights and liberties of my people, and so forth. We would not shed the blood of the Lamanites if they stay in their own land. See, that's all fought on their territory. They do not have troops abroad or foreign bases or things like that. We would not shed the blood of our brethren if they wouldn't rise up and take the sword against us. They didn't do it for being on the wrong side, but because they just meet them in battle, when they take up the sword against us. And this is a saying. Now, this is very strong. You see, verse 9, compare it that. I don't ask for power. It goes this far. He talks about liberty and being free. Well, that's fair, but it isn't rhetoric, you see, because he says in this 12th verse, we would subject ourselves to the yoke of bondage if it were requisite to the justice of God. It isn't just rhetoric to say freedom, freedom, and all this sort of thing. All people use that line. But he says, we would be willing, if it was God's will, we would subject ourselves to the yoke of bondage, to the Lamanites, if it were the will of God, requisite within the justice of God, if he should command us to. After all this talk of liberty, you see, it's very interesting, the people have this big tie there. Thebes was one of the great free cities of Greece, as you know, and if it had been under a dictator, and they finally threw the dictator off, and everybody went around saying, Thebe elefthrei chadzeputheles, which was a joke. It says, Thebes is free, puke where you want to. It's a vile thing to say, you see, but that's all it mentioned. And so Thebes is free, so puke where you want to. As far as that goes, it used a stronger word than that. Because liberty always begins boredom if there's nothing that goes with it. The spoiled, rich men, now this is a phenomenon you commonly find in the missionary, in the military. Spoiled, rich men, young men, like to be drafted, and like I've seen them enjoying themselves for the first time in their lives when they weren't just bored stiff. They like to be told what to do. They like to have to get up at a certain time and be smart and do certain things. They enjoyed it thoroughly. I know the son, one of the richest men in San Francisco, he thought it was great to be done. The first real fun he'd ever had in his life, you see, was this discipline, because he'd never had that. He was just bored sick. Well, this is a very interesting thing, you see. What is your freedom? What is your liberty? And enjoy discipline and the imperatives of necessity. Well, here then, Moroni got this, that liberty. Well, he continues here, and gather together. This is the plan, then. He has a plan, therefore. Come to me speedily with whatever you have. He had Pahoran's strategy. And I'll join up. We'll join up. I have a few provisions for them. I can help you out with that. Gather together whatever force you can. We'll go speedily against the descendants. You've got to get rid of them first, he says, because they own Zarahemla. We'd have nothing to win in the war. They had to spread the war. This was no longer politics, you see. They had spread it abroad, you see. I was somewhat worried concerning you whether I should be just... notice this. It is their own city, it's Zarahemla, it's completely controlled by them. But he said, would that be the right thing to do? After all, they've taken it over. Would it be just, he says, for us to go against our brethren? They still have conscience. As Moroni does, so does Pahoran here. Everyone who has taken up arms and been very aggressive, but he doesn't know whether it's right to go against them or not. But you said that the Lord hath commanded you, so I think it's clear. He's given us a signal, we'll go then in that case. But he hesitated, just as Moroni often hesitated, whether it be the right thing to do. So, hath liberated that liberty wherewithin God hath given us. Is this a special kind of liberty? What kind is it? And so forth. Well, then we start out, I see we've come to the next one. I thought I'd be through with wars today, but we go to another kind now, because very quickly now we'll get to Helaman the next time, and then, we'd better, yes, we will. And then the great crime story. We love crime today. We batten on it, so we're going to get plenty of crime. As Joseph Smith said of the mobs, remember? They want mobs, they'll have plenty of mobs. And of course, after the saints were driven out, then the real bad mobs came, they'll say. The bushwhackers, the jayhawkers, bloody Kansas, and all the rest of it.